When life was slow and oh so mellow, try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a tender and callow fellow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow. Try to remember when life was so tender that no one wept except the willow. Try to remember when life was so tender that dreams were kept beside your pillow. Try to remember when life was so tender that love was an ember above to billow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then follow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, although you know the snow will follow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, without a hurt, the heart is hollow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember, the fire of September that made us mellow. Deep in December, our hearts should remember and follow. Follow, 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 follow.
I was 10 years old when I first saw The Fantastics. It was produced by the Mummers Guild at the University of Cincinnati, directed by my parents' good friend Paul Rutledge. It featured Leroy Reams as the boy. He later went on to Broadway. I saw The Fantastics again off-Broadway, either that year or the next. I'm not sure if Jerry Orbach, who we just heard singing, was in it at that time. I played the song in memory of my mother, Marjorie Mott Gregory, who died this past Monday at 4:45 a.m. I've been a bundle of mixed emotions all week. I can't quite believe my mom's gone, but I'm so grateful to be 60 years old when it happened. Not many people are so lucky, having had a mother who loved them and lived to the ripe old age of 97. But still, she's gone. It leaves a big hole in my life. She's always been there. I guess I just don't know what to feel. Of course, we don't have to know what to feel anyway, do we? Because we're going to feel it. It's the way it works. That's why they call them feelings instead of thinkings, right? Theater was a big part of my life when I was growing up. My dad taught speech and drama at Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati for 37 years. He planned on being 40 years, planned on a real big year in 1970. I would graduate from high school, He would retire after 40 years of teaching, and Mom and Dad would celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. But it didn't happen that way. Mainly because I had some growing up problems. I didn't do too well attending the same school where my dad taught. Never did fit in with my classmates back then. Didn't fit in with any people my own age, even though I tried really hard, and my parents probably tried even harder. I was in Boy Scouts, church choir, public school, but, well, I was different from the other kids. I liked show tunes instead of rock and roll. I followed rules. I wanted to do well in school. Teachers loved me. Kids hated me. It was pretty predictable, really. Mom and Dad were older than the other parents, better educated than most, and I was an only child. When I was little, I'd have my dinner while they had their cocktails. Then I'd head off to bed when they went to the dining room to eat. When I was a little older, I'd be in charge of the hors d'oeuvres, whether it was just the three of us or if they had friends over. I was a little adult, serving everybody. I wasn't at all impressed by the big folks. I was ready to jump in and talk right on their level. As a result, I was completely unable to talk to my peers. It wasn't easy, but it was a wonderful, wonderful childhood nonetheless. Because I knew with my whole heart and soul that I was loved, and I loved them back. When I was in first grade, I spent 6 weeks in an oxygen tent with asthmatic pneumonia. That whole time, in that room in Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, my mom sat faithfully by my side. She must have slept once in a while, but I don't ever remember not being right there in her chair next to the bed, ready to hand me a book or a toy or to read to me or do a crossword, play a game. He felt so sorry when the nurses were using me for target practice with those awful two-a-day penicillin shots. And she held my hand the day that they stuck a huge needle into my belly button to drain some kind of nasty stuff out. I'm pretty sure that Mom had as much to do with my living through that time as did the doctors or the medicines, maybe more. She just wouldn't let me go. In later years, there were times when we had our issues. A few years, we didn't even really talk to each other, but thank God we got past that, and I had a lot more years as Mom defied all the odds and lived on. So just this last week, and I'm so grateful for the good times. My grief is muted, I think. Perhaps mutated into awe. She was a great lady. Thanks for listening. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. And tonight is the first show of our third year. And we look forward to continuing for a long time. And right now I'm proud to put the show into the capable hands of my co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Albert Russo and Sherwood Ross. And so tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Minnesota, Paris, France, Coral Gables, and wherever you are. This is here is Richard Dolan speaking about seeing kids on a playground. These children know they live in a fascist society. Their parents know they live in a fascist society. Is it possible to live in a fascist society without realizing it? Of course it's possible. When you talk about fascism, people instinctively talk about Hitler and Mussolini in brown shirts and walking goose step down the streets. That's fascism that's in your face. Of course it doesn't have to be like that. That's not the defining feature. Fascism can be sexy. Fascism can look like American Idol or Monday Night Football, internet video games, or whatever. It can be the things that distract you, the citizen, from what's actually going on. Fascism, in other words, can be a lot more attractive than you realize to people. What we have is invisible fascism. It's fascism that people can't really see, frankly, because Most people don't have the conceptual tools to understand what's happened. Most people have to work. They've got families. They've got things to do. They're not out there to fight the machine. They're not out there to be heroes. They're just out there to live their lives. They don't want to have trouble. They haven't really studied this matter. They may feel in their bones that there's something wrong. Sure they do. But it's one thing to feel there's something wrong, and it's another to put, be able to put it all together and to conceptualize it and to see how it's wrong. So I see what has happened, that it's a fascism that you can feel, but you can't see it because you don't know how to see it. That's why I call it invisible. That's what we have. In other words, for us to assume that today fascism is going to look like Hitler's fascism, well, that's kind of stupid. We're living in a completely different century, a completely different era. Of course, it's not going to look like Hitler's fascism. It's going to look very different. 9/11 plays a crucial part in allowing that, because what was necessary was to have a legal revolution within the United States. And that, of course, is what 9/11 has allowed. It has allowed a fascist revolution. What else do we call it? It has gone under the radar as such. And that's Richard Dolan. And this is me. Information Clearinghouse today is full of articles about Obama's giving himself license to kill with drones because of this, and his not being interested in who really did 9/11, continuing expanding wars. It seems Obama is another of the neocons, same as Bush, maybe same as them all, who believe in some guy called Leo Strauss more than the founding fathers. These people believe in deception, perpetual war, and religion as a way to distract the masses. It's not what we are taught in sixth grade civics. It's not what we think of as America. But when we take a look at what is happening around us, outside our windows, up and down the freeway as we cruise along, texting to each other about somebody said something about Susan somewhere, that might be what we have. An elite who should lead and the masses who should follow. That's what these people believe. Bush, Obama, Cheney, Rove, Clinton, and Joe Biden, that's what they believe. The people are told what they need to know and no more. Wow. That doesn't seem possible, but go look again out your window. Of course, some will fight back, and the power will crush that revolt, and in doing that will legitimize itself. Some will bravely fight back, but will it be in a way that will destroy us all? Or will it be in a way that makes us all better? We look out our window and ask, where is King? Where is Kennedy? Where is Wellstone? And of course, we know there is only us. There is some writing that addresses our imminent peril that I found on Veterans Today. It suggests that we consider the words of William Blake, a poet, and to also do these things. End assaults on the planet's resources. Regulate limits to capitalist expansion. Restore civil liberties lost in fights against terror. Teach empathy with others who differ from you. Understand your role in perpetuating others' violence. See your enemies as human. None of these come to mind as one rips open the packaging of a new combat video game or watches the national anthem sung as fighter jets stream over the Super Bowl. The words of Blake. To see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. WTF, poetry? When they come to your front door, how are you going to come? With your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun? Or with a poem in your hand? We often feature poets on the New American Dream. Poetry, Take a look out your window and then walk to your kitchen table to try to write a poem within sight of that rifle on the wall. See how powerless that poem is compared to the rifle. Look at the flashing lights and the troops gathering in your street. Then make your choice of weapons very carefully. Well, folks, they, Bush, Obama, Clinton, and company, want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters in 2001. We can do this, but we cannot be afraid.
I'm America will soon end, and nature will live, will have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some famous last words. Christine Todd Whitman, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, speaking about downtown Manhattan in the days after 9/11, the air is safe to breathe. Colin Powell at the UN. My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
Ronald Reagan, approximately 80% of our air pollution stems from hydrocarbons released by vegetation. So let's not go overboard in setting and enforcing tough emission standards for man-made sources. George W. Bush, the same folks that are bombing innocent people in Iraq were the ones who attacked us in America on September the 11th. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright speaking about the millions of deaths caused in Iraq by the sanctions during the Clinton administration. We think it's worth it. Barack Obama, Osama bin Laden has been buried at sea.
Our first guest tonight is Albert Rousseau, an international writer, joining us from Paris, France. Albert, are you there?
Hello, hello, Chuck. How are you all? Now, I have a special thought about your dear mom who passed away a few days ago.
Oh?
And, yes, and I know how hurt you feel, but I will try to make you smile a little bit.
That sounds very good.
By reading an excerpt of my novel Zapinet, the humorous Zapinet series, which I don't think you have read yet.
I've only read a small excerpt of it. I look forward to hearing this.
Okay. So this is the beginning of Parisian Zapinet. Sometimes I really don't know what to do with my Uncle Alberic. He's such a weirdo. Just between you and me, he must have a nut or a bolt missing somewhere. Otherwise, how would his brains be so screwed up the way they are? Grown-ups don't exactly bowl me over with their preposterous shenanigans. As he does every Saturday afternoon, Anki Berkey, the pet name for uncle in French, is Tonton. But he doesn't like me to call him like that, because if I pronounce it Yankee style, it sounds as if he weighed not one, but 2 tons. Though when he drives me up the wall, that's what he deserves. He came to fetch me to go for a stroll in the park. This time, though, it was raining cats and dogs, as they say. To me, it felt more like all the cows of the Loire Valley and Normandy had gathered in the sky like hot air balloons to march against the capital and decided instead all together to take a leak over our heads. Anki Berkey kept saying it was good for the farmers. Did he ask which the snails preferred? To drown in mega puddles by the thousands or get sucked boiled with garlic sauce and end up in French stomachs, maybe next to some poor frog's legs or melted goat cheese? We were walking both wrapped up like those nerds that go visit Niagara Falls, he in his khaki oilskin, it now looks more like faded caca really, and me in my K-way coveralls. Then all of a sudden, he began to run in front of me, yelling in his funny English, Esmeralda, darling, I have to go in the bush. It is pressing. Wait for me, please. When he knows people are listening, he loves to stress my name so that everyone thinks he's talking to some princess. In the beginning, I believed he would really go behind a tree and pee like dogs do. But bush to him means the men's room. He also thinks he can scream his head off when he speaks English, as if I had suddenly become hard of hearing. I know why he does that. He feels more free because it's not his native tongue. But he forgets that in the park there are other English speakers, American mothers with their kids, or with Angler au pair girls pushing the prams of their rich French brats. So, of course, people turn around to stare at us. That's when I want to squash his face, which is pinkish red and reminds me of a lobster Newberg. Boy, do I love lobsters. If they weren't so expensive, I'd eat them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, with no dressing. But seeing the way they toss and turn in those water tanks you see in all the posh seafood restaurants here in Paris gives me the creeps. I wouldn't want to be shrunk like in the movie, finding myself caught between their horribly exaggerated pincers. The bozo who had the original idea of exposing these mega critters alive in front of waiting and hungry customers as if they were just harmless goldfish ought to be horsewhipped. If he's dead, may he be chased after by a million gargoyles. Once as he was performing again, shouting, "The bush!" at the top of his lungs, Unky Berkey scared the wits out of an old granny who kept saying, mon Dieu, I hope he didn't hurt that poor little girl. There are such monsters roaming around. Maybe I should call the warden." She came up to me and whispered, "Are you all right, ma petite? Where is your mummy?" I told her to scram and go look after her cats, because she looked the cat type. She stood there with her mouth wide open, like one of them toothless, wrinkled pussies that have no fur. Like I was saying, after he had come back from the bush, Unky Berkey and I went sloshing across the park. He was wearing galoshes that could have fitted Daffy Duck. Except for oddballs like us, there were only a couple of middle-aged joggers who must have felt doubly wet, dripping all over, plus being soaked under the armpits and between their legs. One of them had bigger boobs than my mom. They were just like two jello caps. He definitely needed a bra. Otherwise, there were very few people in the main alley. They were hurrying with their umbrellas, looking like they badly needed the bush themselves. Well, I still have some time. Hello?
Yes, sure. You've got another 3 or 4 minutes.
But I love the rain, like I love my bath. It gives me the feeling I have wings and gills at the same time. My secret wish is to be reincarnated as a flying fish. To me, they are the most sophisticated beings of our planet. Just consider the dolphins and how they leap out of the water doing all kinds of incredible aerobatics. And we think they want to amuse us. Who's the dope, I ask you? It was through Furman, my mom's current boyfriend, that I learned something apparently serious concerning Unky Berkey. Let me first warn you about my mom. She's a staunch felinist, so she never stays too long with the same guy, because she won't take crap from any bozo. If ever anyone should dare to even think of harassing her, she will beat the daylights out of him. According to Furman, that name suits him. It rhymes with vermin. I shouldn't go around with my uncle, because he's supposed to be a homosexual. I won't let anybody tell me who I'm supposed to go out with, especially not that fascist of a vermin we have at home. I don't understand adults sometimes. What do they mean? Okay, I think it'll be enough for today.
Albert, that was great. Definitely raised my spirits, and
I hope so.
I hope that it enticed our listeners as well as me to grab the book and read it.
So
please,
I want to tell you that Zapinette is a series of now 7 books, and
uh-huh.
She roams around the world. That is Zapinette in Paris. Then she moves on with her quirky, funny uncle to Italy, and then she goes to New York. And has strange adventures there, and then after that to the Holy Land, and even to South Africa, to the Rainbow Country. So you can imagine the things she goes through, and she tells you about these countries in her own words, you see.
Well, I'm definitely going to have to read some more of Zeppanet. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find Zeppanet?
So, if you look on Amazon or Google, you just click on Zeppanet, Gosh Zeppanet, Zapinette, because she zaps, you know, from one film to the other, from the internet to the television. That's why her uncle called him Zapinette. Gosh Zapinette, you'll see that in Amazon, or you Google it.
Well, great.
That's it. And there are already 4 e-books.
Good. Okay. Many of us like to read e-books. I want to. Out there.
Yeah, and they're not expensive. So
that's
if you want to have a good laugh,
mm-hmm.
if you think this is funny, well, you know, you just go to Amazon and pick one of the 4 Zapinets that you will find there.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us, Albert. Appreciate your...
And thanks a lot for having me again so frequently, and I enjoyed very much. And I also enjoyed the very serious talk that preceded my Zapinet.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you liked it.
Thanks a lot, Chuck, and hello to all our American listeners from Paris.
Well, Bear, and have a good night.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much again.
America will soon end and nature will live. Have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. Some more famous last words. This is Gene Kirkpatrick, member of Ronald Reagan's cabinet, speaking on the kidnapping, rape, and murder of American nuns in El Salvador. The nuns were not just nuns. The nuns were political activists. The Apollo 11 astronauts had a press conference 3 weeks after they were supposed to have been on the moon. Neil Armstrong, we were never able to see stars without looking through the optics. Michael Collins, I don't remember seeing any. Neil Armstrong's speech at 25th anniversary of Apollo 11. There are great ideas, undiscovered breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of the truth's protective layers.
Janet Reno on burning children alive at Waco. Our concern was for the children. Ronald Reagan. What we have found in this country, and maybe we're more aware of it now, is one problem that we've had, even in the best of times, and that is the people who are sleeping on the grates, the homeless, who are homeless, you might say, but by choice.
Barack Obama, I'm aware that some would question the events of 9/11, but let us be clear, Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people that day. Larry Silverstein, you had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is to pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
FDR on Pearl Harbor. This is a day that will live in infamy. The McCollum Memo, also known as the 8 Action Memo, suggested that the United States provoked Japan into committing an overt act of war. The memo illustrates several people in the Office of Naval Intelligence who promoted the idea of goading Japan into war. It's not believed that in the present state of political opinion, the United States government is capable of declaring war against Japan without more ado,
if by the eight-point plan, Japan could be led to commit an overt act of war, so much the better.
And now we bring you the new American Dream masterpiece, classic, playhouse, theater, something, something. Real voices with a message that you will not hear on the Today Show, Fox News, National Public Radio, CBS Nightly News, or the Sunday morning political talk shows. This is from Douglas Horn. Douglas Horn graduated from The Ohio State University in 1974 with a BA in history and served as a junior officer in the U.S. Navy for 10 years, followed by 10 more years with the Navy as a civil servant in an anti-submarine warfare program.
Douglas Horn, why doesn't the government reopen the Kennedy case? Why doesn't the government admit there was a massive cover-up? Why don't they admit the Warren Commission was selling a fairy tale, that the House Committee on Assassinations told a revised version of the same fairy tale?
If any president of the United States, if you put yourself in their shoes, politicians, senators, congressmen, and any chief executive, as soon as they say anything about the Kennedy assassination, that would indicate they don't agree with the official version. It would raise a massive uproar. I think that everyone hides behind a wall of silence, quite frankly, out of cowardice. The cover-up of this assassination was implemented in the 1960s by guilty men and by people who knew they were telling lies. But from the mid-70s on, the cover-up has been perpetuated by cowards. It's really tragic. People in this country don't need to be protected from the truth. We've had three assassinations in the 60s. Nobody believes the official stories on King, RFK, or JFK. We've had Vietnam. We've had Watergate. We've had Iran-Contra. And we had the lies about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We don't need to be protected from the truth. We can handle the truth. If we can learn the truth, we can move forward with confidence and try to prevent those things from happening again. But you're not ever going to find anyone in the U.S. government who wants to do anything with this case again. In South Africa, we had truth commissions, and people told the truth after apartheid was over, and at least people came to understand their own history a little better. These people in the United States who really know the truth about all that has happened, can't tell the truth, because then nobody would pay their taxes, nobody would care about the military budget anymore, and everyone will get thrown out of office. Douglas Horn. Now I'd like to introduce or welcome our second guest, Sherwood Ross. He's been with us many times as a columnist. Sherwood Ross is an award-winning journalist who formerly worked for the City News Bureau of Chicago, the Chicago Daily News, and for several wire services. He is the author of Gruning of Alaska and several produced plays. He was active in the U.S. civil rights movement and was press coordinator for James Meredith's March Against Fear in Mississippi. Welcome, Sherwood.
I'm calling Sherwood right now, Mike.
Okay.
Hello.
Sherwood, welcome to the New American Dream.
Yes, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead and take it away, Sherwood.
Well, the man President Obama wants to run the CIA, that's John Brennan, told the Senate Intelligence Committee today that drone strikes are only used against persons planning to attack America. Brennan said the reason the CIA killed an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, in Yemen 2 years ago was because he was intimately involved in activities to kill innocent men, women, and children. Now, a statement like that makes you wonder what kind of lunatic Mr. Obama wants to run the CIA. How can Brennan oppose the killing of American civilians when that's exactly what the CIA drone attacks are doing in Pakistan, killing large numbers of their civilians, not only some random suspects. Mr. Brennan was top terrorism aide to Mr. Obama, as Obama escalated his drone strikes from 50 under President Bush to more than 360 in his first term. The CIA attacks supposedly focused primarily on Al-Qaeda and Taliban targets in the tribal regions of Pakistan and in Yemen, which is where al-Awlaki was killed along with his 16-year-old son and another man. Mr. Obama told the New York Times he takes personal responsibility for the drone attacks, but that hardly makes them right. He has been killing people without bothering with the law. And while what the victims may have done has yet to be proven in a court of law, what Mr. Obama is doing to them is murder, pure and simple, by his own admission. Mr. Obama makes the point that only terrorists are being killed. He wants the public to believe that only criminals are targeted, but that's absurd. The drones are terrorizing the 400,000 civilians who live in Waziristan, who never know when and where the drones are going to strike, and who've been deprived of their peace of mind and more. Mr. Obama is punishing the region's entire civilian population rather than ask the governing officials of the area to arrest the suspect, which is a legal way to do it, and then present evidence against the person. Instead, the drones are bringing civilized life to a halt. Some of us recall the German air raids on London during the World War II Blitz. These raids lasted perhaps 30 minutes to a couple of hours, and then the all clear was sounded. But when the drones are in the skies all day and all night, and their motors may be heard on the ground, there's no all clear. The terror is constant. Question: how can you punish an entire region in order to seek revenge for 9/11 on one or two suspected individuals, or a dozen or 20. There is no selection process here. One where President Obama says the screening has been tight. This is just the opposite. Everybody is affected. Let's say you're an innocent civilian with no ties to any person who might be suspected by the Americans. As you go about your daily chores, you hear the sound of the drones above you. Since you know what a powerful weapon the Hellfire missile that they fire is, you come to live in perpetual fear that you or your loved ones might be attacked in error. Why? Because it has happened so many times before, and everybody there knows it. What's happening is that people are afraid to get into their cars and drive. One man attacked lay wounded in his car. Instead of calling for help, he bravely cried out his rescuers to keep away, because the CIA would probably send another Hellfire missile in a few minutes that would kill the first responders too. And that's exactly what happened, and the man was killed in his car. The Hellfires, made in Orlando, Florida, by the Lockheed Martin Company, which just gave a dividend to its stockholders. These Hellfires pack a devastating wallop. Besides explosives, they eject shrapnel over the surrounding area, and they can also kill you by asphyxiation. So people are afraid to go to their jobs, to go to work, to meet in groups, and to send their children in school or even let them go out and play. They fear to go to the grocery store. They are afraid to go to their mosques or churches. The fact is, President Obama has turned their lives upside down, and in John Brennan, he has a strong defender of his policies. You know, high Pentagon officials have called the drones, admitted that they're extrajudicial weapons, and that means not legal. And while President Obama says only actual terrorists are killed, in fact, many first responders have been killed. I mean, how can the CIA know who is going to rush to the scene of a murder? How can they know that the victim's children or wives will not come to claim the body? How can they know that doctors or firefighters or police have not rushed to the scene? The fact is they can't know. And so many of these people have been murdered as well. What's happening in Pakistan is nothing less than the mass torture and massacre of innocent people struggling to survive under the threat or actual attack of drones. As I've said before, the CIA is the greatest criminal organization ever on the face of the earth. President Obama, before he entered the White House, was a CIA payroller for a number of years, and he authorized his first drone strike on only his second day of holding office. And that tells you something about how high on his agenda he rates the drone attacks. It also says that the CIA has an awful lot to say about how the U.S. is run. Please tell me, explain it. Is there any reason why this man, who is spreading hatred of our country with all his extrajudicial killings as never before in history, should not be removed from office? There he sits in the White House, ruling America and the world like a Roman emperor in the Colosseum, turning thumbs down on the gladiators, deciding who shall live and who shall die. No courts, no lawyers, no juries, no evidence. And that those who believe like him, such as John Brennan, will probably be confirmed as the next CIA head, only reflects the kind of lunatic asylum that the United States of America has become. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Wow.
Thank you, Sherwood, and have a good night.
You too.
America will soon end, and nature will live, have the last word. Nature bats last, as the saying goes. A few more famous last words. Lyndon Johnson, his midnight address on the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Open aggression on the high seas. Air strikes are on the way to retaliate.
George W. Bush. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. Every effort will be made to spare the lives of innocent civilians. The campaign will be broad and concerted and will use decisive force. No outcome but victory will be accepted. America's freedom will be defended, and freedom will be brought to others. George H.W. Bush, just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. Again, George H.W. Bush, my fellow citizens, last night I ordered military forces to Panama. The Warren Commission on the JFK murder. The shots which killed President Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. J. Robert Oppenheimer, upon seeing the first atomic explosion, it worked. On the Wellstone assassination, the National Transportation Safety Board, the likely cause of the accident was the failure of both the pilot and co-pilot to maintain a safe minimum airspeed, leading to a stall from which they could not recover.
It was supposed to be a routine campaign stop. In a poor section of Indianapolis, a largely black crowd had waited an hour to hear the presidential candidate speak. The candidate, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, had been warned not to go by the city's police chief. As his car entered the neighborhood, his police escort left him. Once there,
He stood on the back of a flatbed truck. He turned to an aide and asked, "Did they know about Martin Luther King?"
They didn't, and it was left to Kennedy to tell them that King had been shot and killed that night in Memphis, Tennessee. The crowd gasped in horror. Kennedy spoke of King's dedication to love and to justice between fellow human beings, adding that he died in the cause of that effort. And Kennedy sought to heal the racial wounds that were certain to follow by referring to the death of his own brother, President John F. Kennedy.
For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. Many other American cities burned after King was killed, but there was no fire in Indianapolis, which heard the words of Robert Kennedy. An historian says a well-organized black community kept its calm. It's hard to overlook the image of one single man standing in a flatbed truck who never looked down at the paper in his hand, but only at the faces in the crowd. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. 2 months later, Robert Kennedy himself was felled by an assassin's bullet.
Nina Rhodes Hughes, who was an eyewitness of the Robert Kennedy murder, standing behind Kennedy in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, says, "What has to come out is that there was another shooter to my right. The truth has got to be told. No more cover-ups."
If we do not act, if good men and women do nothing, America and the world will soon end. Unless we can find out who's behind the curtain pulling the levers, unless we find the courage, the heart, the brains to journey into that unknown, it will all be over. Because it seems we're not in Kansas anymore.
Well, it has been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. You might have seen that George H.W. Bush still lives. That old snake that we saw sneering in the back room on the night his son was dishonestly named President of the United States. The one who lied that he was out of the loop. The one who ordered the killing of thousands of people in Panama. The one who ordered the building of many new prisons to get tough on drugs and criminals in America, and it was all a scam. All to get elected, gain power. The one who sneered at the funeral of Gerald Ford when he mentioned from the podium the killing of John Kennedy. The one who claimed he was not in Dallas that day, but there is a photo showing he was there. The one who sits in the front row at the baseball games on national television and is applauded, not hit with tomatoes and fists and handcuffs, because he has been so successful in concealing the truth from the American people all these years. The one who has said that if American people knew what he has done, they would string him up by a light pole. Well, there were some guys right here in Mount Liberty, some guys who knew the truth about George H.W. Bush, who cared enough to find out the goddamn truth about our 41st president. They were not the leading citizens. They did not write the editorials or sign the loans or even cut the hair of those who did. They inhabited the underground, the earth, the destitute, the hated, the laughed at, the so-called criminals themselves, and they understood. They knew where the power resided, where the truth could be found, what the reasons were, where the bodies were buried. And they could not understand, and they wanted to find someone to ask why there might be such a stink about even talking about the killing of a rich so-called leader, and yet the real-life slaughter of thousands, millions of poor people goes by without a whisper. A passing breeze in the trees that is gone and forgotten by the time the hail fellow well met in the cook's hat in the backyard shouts that the hot dogs are ready. And so, with nothing better to do, they decided to fight. KGB, they said, kill George Bush.
Babies were born, went to the first day of school, some with a father, some with a mother, some by themselves. 12 years and more followed because there was no choice, as if no one cared. Day after day, things happened, as they will, and still no one cared. The jail squatted beneath the Aces County Courthouse, invisible as a good boy to those walking outside, known only for the white vans disappearing into the yawning jaws of the off-white overhead door to the enclosed parking lot. Each weekday morning, the door would groan and open, just enough for the van to reappear to take inmates up the street to the federal courthouse. Those prisoners needing to appear in county court would walk. They'd crowd handcuffed and shackled into the elevator in the jail front lobby with two guards for the ride up two floors. The door would open into the world of color, people in a hurry, people whose days flew by, people with smiles on their faces, people with faces serious about nothing. The door would open and reveal the load of orange men with scraggly matted hair, men with no reason to shave, who just walked into a department store holding the hand of a little girl, and the girl asked the sleeping man what she could have, and he said nothing, and he woke up in jail with real tears coming down his cheeks. The door split in two and revealed to the hurried people a crowded little room of orange men, who were the reason for the huge building of marble and concrete and stone and hardwood and the salad bar and lounge. These almost men with their bowed heads and tangled hands propped in front of their waists like they were hiding a wet spot shuffled crossway over the lanes of traffic with difficulty, like passing through a cornfield against the rows. Two brown men stood on the sides of the orange men, keeping them from touching the hurried people who carried papers concerning the lives and children of the orange men. In 3 seconds, four, the orange and brown men slipped inside the lonesome door that led to the damp holding tank outside the rear courtroom door. And above the stomach-clenching courthouse, after the orange men had been locked in yet another small room, an eagle played on the waves of heat rising from the small city.
She dipped and lowered her wings and never worried about being spotted. The focus of the ground creatures was down. The eagle admired the town square pattern around the courthouse, the row of barbershops and salons, Sam's Shop, Wave This, corner grocery store, bookstore, city offices, some library, and 5 banks. The eagle let the heat from the downtown midday traffic take her up another whoosh. She saw the schools, public on the east side, and Catholic downtown. The eagle loved to admire her black and white feathers in the sun and her face reflecting in the wing mirror so far above the ground, the ground. The eagle imagined Mount Liberty as a place for bovine types, carpenters, salesmen, and ministers who held only shared thoughts. When they told each other what they thought, they always already knew these people.
just lucky to be able to soar, above all that. The smell from the Wiener factory, sweet like burnt molasses over manure pancakes, kept the eagle from the south edge of town. She climbed a winding staircase. The motion below slowed and slowed until it stopped. The blond man, now halfway through his 44th year, his arms covered in orange, sat at the orange D-block day room table. A California surfer type who'd never seen an ocean, he dealt solitaire, facing the 12-inch color television above the cell door. He counted three cards, turned the last one up. He held it between middle finger and thumb, passing the card like a wand over the layout, then pressing the card into the slush pile. In front of him, two black men ranted. He decided not to hear. A Mexican type sat at the table with the blonde man, his elbows on the tabletop, his legs stretched ahead. Another young guy paced up and down, his greasy hair stuck to his forehead, drumming with two pencils on each cell he passed, then tapping the air in between. He hummed. He sang. Na, 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 hey, hey, my, my. The card player listened to the young man's routine through The Price is Right and Love Boat. It's goodbye, he said, without looking up.
The young man skidded to a stop. He wore blue boat shoes without socks. His orange jumpsuit came to the tops of his ankles. He wore his collar turned up like Elvis Presley. His sleeves were rolled tight over his thin biceps. Say what, dude, he said. He leaned down at the older man, beard coming through in white nubs. Am I bothering you, man, the young man said. He put his foot on the bench seat and leaned a forearm on his thigh. He let his invisible band, tapping his pencils on the table to a magnified beat. No, the song, it's hey, 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 goodbye, the older man said, still studying his cards. Who asked you? The young man's face flickered, then flamed. Red spots appeared on his neck. He leaned to glare into the heart of the older man. The older man looked away from his cards and into the soft eyes and the dried snot in the nostrils, the redness around the nose.
The older man's various parts became ready, like a submarine crew called to general quarters, late in an 11th month at sea. All the younger man noticed was a slight tightening of the other man's jaw, like tendrils in the shoulders of a lion. The eyes of the blond man mesmerized the young fellow, the older one as impassive as a house cat, observing a black bird out the window. There was no hatred or affectation in the older man's face. Like the cat, he would rip apart his prey without emotion. The young man did not see the left fist that hit his right temple and crashed his head against the cell bars. He saw only a flash of the blue shoe that sent blood gushing from his nose. Then the shoe thudded against the clenched stomach. The other shoe landed in the groin. The older man returned to his table. He drew a homemade cigarette from a Marlboro pack. One of the black men offered a match.
Bobby Ford, who had been standing nearby watching the TV, grabbed the young man lying on his side with his arms locked between his legs. Ford hugged him from behind and dragged him into his cell. Ford gritted his teeth and fell with his load onto the bottom bunk, then grabbed the legs and flipped them onto the bed. He hurried out of the cell as the guard's hard shoes clicked down the shiny hall floor. The Mexican type shot up and faced the guard through the bars. Hey, man, he said, I got court today, man. The short, stocky guard leaned to see around the prisoner. examined left and right, leaning. He paced back and forth, looking into each cell, squinting to see the 10 feet into the dark rooms, homes. What's wrong with him? He stopped and pointed a size 20 triple E walkie-talkie at the man on the bunk with his back to the door. He shined his flashlight. Sleeping, said Stephen Baltimore, one of the black men. The other black, Martin Mumford, walked over to the cell door and hollered, Hey, dude, wake up, wake up. The man here wants to talk to you. No, it's okay, the guard said. Must have been C-Block again, son of a bitch. I heard that, Bert, said Stephen. They make a racket.
Ford walked over and reached to turn the television down. The blonde man passed another card over his game, laid it on the 10 of hearts, trying to sneak up on his breath. Don Burton waddled away and turned the corner. He stopped and listened. The men in D-Block waited until they heard the keys again. The salesman, Bobby Ford, turned up the sound. He stood directly under the TV with his arms folded, trying to see under the dresses of the women on the screen. Changing scenes on the set reflected off the spot in the middle of his head. Stephen called Bobby ER because the bald spot resembled an alien landing zone where the cows are found surgically mutilated. Bobby wiped the palm of his right hand across the spot, leaving his left arm across his chest. He got a rash whenever he came to jail. He returned the right arm to the waiting left one and moved in closer, tilting his chin toward the ceiling. He's got hairs growing out his nose. Bobby looked back to Mark Pontiac at his card game.
Uh-huh, said the blonde Pontiac without looking up. He ran off 3 torn cards. Who? The television news showed the courthouse. Each head in the block shot up. Martin and Stephen pointed at the set. Bill Morningdub appeared in his cell door, drying his hair with a thin white towel. That guy. That's the courthouse, said Morningdub. No shit, Chief, said Mumford. Turn that up, said Baltimore. Ford didn't move. Fucking freak. Mumford stepped in and turned up the sound.
2 young policemen in dark blue pants and light blue shirts, followed by a phalanx of stern men in suits and sunglasses, pulled a medium-height, middle-aged white man with a large nose and coal black hair down the court steps. The police officers aimed for the car while the man watched the crowd. The scene switched to Dan Rather in Washington. Michael Zag has been charged with threatening the life of President George Bush, Rather read from the paper on his desk. He wore a pinstripe shirt with red suspenders. The only morning, his red tie was loosened. Behind him, 2 Spring Columbia graduates holding blank pieces of paper hurried every which way, grinning at each other.
Sources say federal authorities are preparing charges of conspiracy against Zags. President Bush is scheduled to visit Mount Liberty in the coming months. Bush, a former World War II pilot, will fly a stealth B-2 bomber from Washington, D.C. to the Mount Liberty National Guard wing. The 185th Air Guard will become the first unit in the country to employ a stealth.
The screen showed a Batwing B-2 taking off from Fort Bragg. Authorities say Zags, a laborer for a construction firm, made comments to fellow workers which were threatening to the president. He was arrested at the job site, the Mount Liberty Irving Elementary School's new gym. The scene turned to footage of the job foreman talking to a police officer. Zags is being held at the Mount Liberty Jail. We'll have more on our evening report. Now we return you to your local programming. Bobby Ford twirled on his left heel. His arms remained folded at his chest. He squeezed himself tighter and shuffled to the card table. He's coming here. Ford leaned over. Mark Pontiac asked Ford who he was. The guy on TV. They'll be coming in here. They got to put him in the felony tank. Said he was being held in the city jail, and he ain't here yet, so he'll be coming. I ain't taking no roommate. I like it like it is. It's already crowded, he whispered.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another New American Dream Radio show. Once again, this is the start of our third year. We hope you'll keep coming back and listening to our show. And we've got 16 days left on our fundraiser where we're trying to raise enough to keep us going for the whole year instead of our having to go month to month. We sure appreciate anything that any of you put in there. Just visit our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. Take a look in the left column. You'll see a link to get to the fundraiser. Once again, we'd like to thank you for listening. We'd like to thank worldnewstrust.com and June2508.com, our two sponsors. And I'd like to thank you, Mike. Good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabas. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.